Welcome, everyone. On behalf of National Law Foundation, my name is Steve Siegel, and our program today is Planning with Spousal Lifetime Access Trusts, a reference that we often call SLATs.
For attorneys who wish to use this recorded program via audio CD or MP3 for CLE credit in six states, Illinois, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Utah. During the presentation, the speaker will pause briefly while I read a program code. This code is not required for attorneys completing the course online at nlfonline.com for CLE credit in any states. This course has no New York CLE value. Attorneys from these six states who are using any format of recorded media will be required to record the program code to their participant critique or evaluation forms. Again, these announcements pertain only to Illinois, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Utah CLE credit when using recorded media. For credit in other states, please check your course book.
As I'm sure all of you understand, we are in very interesting times in terms of tax and estate planning. The biggest problem we're facing in dealing with our clients is we're not sure what the law is going to be within the next few months. And that is beyond frustrating. I have clients come to me and say, I want a simple plan that makes sense, that works for myself, my spouse, my family. I don't want it to be overly complicated. I don't want it to be super expensive. And I want it to last a while. And I say to them, no problem, I've got you covered. You just have to answer three questions and we're good to go. And they say, fine, what are those questions? Question one, what is the value of your assets? Question two, in what year will you die? Question three, what will the law be in the year you die? And of course the clients give me that quizzical look that I expect. And I say to them, they say to me, well, I can't answer all those questions. And then I respond by saying, well, now your planning is going to be a little more complicated than you might have liked. And that's where we are. We don't know answers to basic questions like how much can I give away? How much can I leave my family? How much can I deal with in terms of spouses and things of that nature? So what do we need to do? What we need to do as planners is to be aware of where the law is today, where the law might be going based on some of the proposals that are out there in the political world, that some of which are likely to pass in the next few months or in the next 6 months to a year, and we need to address those issues. So where do we start? We start by recognizing where we are today. We have this $11.7 million exclusion, which is a wonderful exclusion. It's the largest we've ever had. It's based on the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. That act says, however, that after 2025, that 11.7 million indexed for inflation until 25 is going to be reduced. It's going to be going back beginning in 26 at where it was in 2017, indexed for subsequent deflation. So it was about 5.5 million then. So we're looking at maybe $6 million number in 2026. But is that going to be the number that our clients are going to focus on? Well, doesn't seem to be, because we have political risk. We have political risk in that we have Senator Sanders' bill introduced in the Senate and also introduced in the House, the 99.5% Act, saying that that exclusion should be lowered significantly. $1 million for gifting during lifetime, $3.5 million for transfers at death, increasing the federal estate tax percentage from 40% to 45% for estates over up to 10 million, 50% between 10 and 50 million, higher for persons in higher atmospheres of wealth. That's a big change. So what we're looking at is the opportunity that we have today to take advantage of this exclusion, to take advantage of the opportunity to transfer as much wealth as our clients are willing to transfer and able to transfer while this exclusion is still available to us. The phrase I use all the time in a friendly way talking to clients is, you can use it or you can lose it. If you can't make up your mind what to do, if you can't pull the trigger on planning, if you say, I'm going to wait and see what they pass, that might be too late. One of the bills that one of the senators has introduced, the Senator Ben Holland from Maryland, he's introduced a bill that is retroactive to January 1st of 21 with big changes. In my view, it's unlikely that would be passed with a retroactive date. The US Supreme Court has said retroactivity is possible in a tax law. They've allowed it to happen. A couple of cases, one's called United States versus Carlton, decided about 30 years ago or so. But even if they don't make it retroactive, that bill could pass. And if they make it retroactive, then it's too late to act. But the real concern on a more practical basis is they could say it's effective the date of enactment. And you could have a situation where the House and Senate could pass a bill at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and the president could sign it at 8 or 9 o'clock the same morning, and now it's enacted. And when you wake up and you turn on your news as you're having your morning coffee, it's too late to do anything because it's all done. I don't want my clients to be in that situation. I suggest you don't either. So we need to make sure people understand if they're going to do something, they need to act soon. The good news is if you use your exclusion, it will not be clawed back, meaning that if you give away $10 or $11 million before they change any laws, and if they change the laws to 1 or 3 million or some other lower number, they're not going to come back after you and make you pay tax on the money you already gave away. So this is the planning that we need to think about. So now what we have come up with as planners, there's a tool that makes this possible, that makes it work, and that has become extremely favorable and popular all over the country. Everyone can use this planning. You don't have to be over 11 million. You don't have to be a mega millionaire. You need to be someone who wants to use their exclusion. And that planning technique is the spousal lifetime trust, the spousal lifetime access trust, the SLAT, as it's given that acronym. So what is a SLAT? A SLAT's a trust. It's a trust where a donor spouse makes a gift to an irrevocable trust that benefits the donee spouse. So we have the donor spouse giving the beneficiary spouse is the trust beneficiary that he or she is now receiving this benefit. In setting up the trust is designed to provide distributions to the beneficiary spouse, but the beneficiary spouse is not considered the owner of the property. He or she is a trust beneficiary. So that way, he or she does not have an inclusion in the beneficiary spouse's estate when that person passes on. Okay, so how do we make this work? And how do we get to use the exclusion of the donor spouse? We have the donor spouse make as generous a gift as he or she is willing to make. And we do not qualify that transfer for the gift tax marital deduction. That is a key consideration. Because if we hadn't qualified for the marital deduction, then when the beneficiary spouse died, it would be in the beneficiary spouse's estate, and it would not use up any of the donor spouse's exclusion. Marital gifts don't absorb exclusion and end up being taxable in the estate of the beneficiary spouse. All right, so when we make the gift, donor spouse makes the gift, no marital deduction used. So now the donor spouse has used as much of his or her transfer tax exemption as he or she is willing to use up. Let's say it's $11 million. You have a client wealthy enough to make an $11 million gift, and that person is using up $11 million of their $11.7 million exclusion. So they've used it. If in future years, the exclusion drops to 1 million or 3 million, that donor spouse has maxed out his or her gifting, but at no tax cost. That person has used the free transfer and owes nothing. All right, so that's good news for the donor spouse. In thinking about this, not only are we taking some advantage of the use of the federal exclusion, we also possibly are taking advantage of a state exclusion. What if you live in a state that has an estate tax? So if you transfer assets into a trust where the donor spouse is removing those assets from the donor's estate, keeping them out of the beneficiary's estate, you're potentially reducing the exposure of the family assets to state estate tax. Even if the person has $5 or $6 or $3 or $4 million, which obviously is less than the federal 11, but might be more than some states' exclusions. Oregon's a million, Massachusetts is a million, Illinois is 4 million, other states are in the range of 2 to 5 million. So you could be saving some state estate tax as well as you're thinking about doing this. What does this trust look like? We can make the terms of this trust very flexible. We can have a trust that says, because we aren't required to pay anything to the wife, we can have multiple beneficiaries. So we can say that this is a sprinkling trust, a discretionary trust with the spouse perhaps as the only beneficiary during life, or maybe the spouse and the children, and maybe even grandchildren as potential discretionary beneficiaries. That's the family decision as to how much you want to disperse the income and or the principal in these circumstances. Generally, we keep these more for the spouse. We'll make the spouse the primary beneficiary, but we do have the option to include other people as we think about how this is going to go. But we are incurring no gift tax liability, or keeping the gift under the exclusion, and we're using the exemption while it's out there. The use it or lose it is being honored by using it. All right, let's say we set this up and the donor spouse makes an $11 million transfer to the donee spouse's trust, and then the donor spouse dies. Will that $11 million asset, or whatever it's worth at death, be includable in the donor spouse's estate? The answer is no. Why? Well, because you gave it away. You did not retain an interest in it. You couldn't revoke it. The trust is irrevocable. You didn't retain a right to the income. You didn't retain control over anything. So it's not part of the donor spouse's estate. It's also not part of the beneficiary spouse's estate, because he or she didn't transfer the property to the trust, and he or she is not the owner of the property. He or she is a discretionary beneficiary who may get the use and benefit of the property, but not being the transferor eliminates the beneficiary spouse from having an estate tax concern. And as I mentioned earlier, because the law says there won't be any clawback, any amount of the exemption that was used, that escapes federal estate tax. It doesn't come back into the donor's estate. So this is a plan that has had significant traction, as I say, all over the country. People are liking this plan. If you want to be even more thoughtful in your planning and look down the road even further, something else you can do in creating this trust is you can also bring in the generation skipping transfer tax exclusion. You could say, for example, that this trust is for the benefit of the spouse for life, then to the children for life, and then to the grandchildren, either outright or in further trust for them and generations beyond them. That's a dynasty trust. So now we've accomplished two things here. We've used a significant portion or all of the donor spouse's gift tax exemption, and we could also use some or all of the donor spouse's generation skipping exemption, which is also $11.7 million. So again, if we're thinking of political risk, do we think that in the current government discussions we're hearing, are they going to continue to allow people to leave to their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren and more distant generations $22, $23 million as a married couple tax-free? That may end. Even if other things don't end, that may end, because people will say that's overly generous and why should we allow that much of tax-free transfer to go on? Well, here's an opportunity. Nothing's been enacted yet. We have the opportunity to create these multi-generational trusts. As you're thinking about that, where do you live? if you live in a state that has a rule against perpetuities, which is the rule that says trusts have to end at a particular time, how long is your rule go for? Some states have the shortest rule. That's the old-fashioned English law rule of lives in being when you create the trust, plus 21 years. Other states have a uniform act that says 90 years. But many states have either extended the rule against perpetuities to hundreds of years. Florida and Georgia are at 360. Nevada is at 365. Wyoming is at 1,000. And a number of states have just repealed the rule completely, saying, let the trust go for as long as it can go. No end date. So this is another part of the planning opportunity. For how much longer will we be able to take advantage of these big numbers for the generation skipping and the gift tax as exempt numbers, totally within the law, totally appropriate to do, don't need any special permission from the government. You file a gift tax return when the due date of that return comes up. You disclose that you gave away an amount of wealth beneath under the amount of the exclusion. You owe no tax and you're fine. So this is something that we need to be making sure clients understand. The SLAT needs to be an irrevocable trust. The donor or spouse has to transfer the assets that he or she is willing to transfer with no strings attached. Because if you say the trust is revocable, then it's going to be in the estate of the donor or spouse. That's code section 2038. That's a basic rule. Revocable trust, come back into your estate. So the trust has to be irrevocable. We would say, as I've been suggesting, that the beneficiary spouse is usually the primary beneficiary, gets income or principal in the discretion of the trustee. But if the marriage of the donor and beneficiary spouse is sound, as one would hope it would be if you're giving a trust for your spouse $11 million or $5 million or some millions of dollars, the beneficiary spouse can certainly share the income that he or she is receiving with the donor spouse. So the donor spouse has no right to that income, has no control over it. But if the family is understanding the planning here, you make the transfer and the donor spouse is entitled to share with the beneficiary spouse the income and, if necessary, the principal that is being generated in that trust situation. Okay, so how are we going to fund this thing? Well, we can fund it with all kinds of assets. We can fund it with stocks and bonds. We can fund it with business interests. We can fund it with income producing real estate or investment real estate. We can even fund it with life insurance. So we have a very broad opportunity to have the donor spouse look at his or her asset base and say, how do I get a lot of this out of my estate into a trust for my spouse that I can still have access to based upon my relationship with my spouse? Make sure if you're funding a SLAT that you only use assets that are owned by the donor spouse. The trust that the donor is creating only use assets that are owned by the donor spouse. Do not use joint assets, because if you use joint assets, the beneficiary spouse will be viewed as transferring assets for his or her own behalf. Well, that is going to make them taxable when the beneficiary spouse dies. So we have to keep everything separate. And that is important to make that the case. Do not split the gift. If you split the gift, you're making the beneficiary spouse a transferor. That's going to create a tax problem for the beneficiary spouse down the road, because he or she will be viewed as making a transfer for his or her own estate. So we have to make sure that we are stepping back in describing this to the client. It's not just enough to say, you need a document that's going to make all this work. You definitely do. You need a document that's going to make this work. NLF Forms has such a document if that's something you're looking for. So we are in a position to get you the right paperwork. If you're in a community property state, be very careful. If you put community property into this trust, What are you doing? You're putting property that both spouses have an ownership interest in, and that's going to make a portion of the trust taxable when the surviving spouse, beneficiary spouse, dies. So we have to keep this as separate property. Is there enough separate property in the hands of each spouse to make this work? If not, you may have to convert some community property to separate property to line up the pieces the way we want to see this lined up. So this is the general plan, a trust created by a donor spouse for the benefit primarily, maybe exclusively, of the beneficiary spouse, possibly allowing children and or grandchildren to be future beneficiaries or possibly current beneficiaries. What we are achieving in creating and establishing this trust is the use of the exclusion while it is still the large number we can use today. If Senator Sanders' plan becomes law, $1 million becomes your lifetime gift. Anything over that, you pay tax at 45%. Under current law, $11.7 million is your lifetime gift. Anything over that, you'd pay tax on at 40%. Well, if the law changes, where do you want to be as an advisor? You want to be ahead of the curve here. You want to be at least to have been able to say, I told my clients about this opportunity. I gave them the opportunity and the chance to put something together that I could draft for them, that I could work with them on. If they said, let me think about it, and they never made a decision and the law changed, don't blame me. I brought it to your attention. The old cliche about leading horses to water and not, you can't make them drink it. I get that. But if we don't lead them to the water, then it's our fault, because we know more about what's coming down the road or what might be coming down the road than the client does. The client might be watching evening news shows and hear a rumor or see a story in a newspaper about discussions about things that might come, but the client doesn't understand. If you said to the client, what's your GST exclusion amount? What's your annual exclusion amount? What's your lifetime exclusion amount? How much can you transfer at death? What are adjusted taxable gifts? They have no idea. We understand these things, or hopefully we do, as the planners and the people that bring these issues to bear. So we need to make sure the clients understand it. It's a great opportunity to get in front of your client and say, there are things coming possibly in the law that perhaps will be very injurious to your wealth. And if we do some things now, we can protect that wealth. If we don't, that wealth might wind up having a significant portion of it end up in the hands of the government that maybe wouldn't have been the case if we'd done some planning. So these are things you want to be aware of. Some of the tax issues that we have to discuss. The SLAT is a grantor trust because the donor spouse is putting income into a trust for the benefit of the donor spouse's wife. And under code section 677A, that makes the trust a grantor trust. So the grantor, the donor spouse, is responsible for paying the income tax. You might say, oh, well, that's kind of a harsh blow here. You're making the donor spouse be the donor, giving up assets, but the donor spouse is still paying the income tax, even though he or she is not entitled to receive the income. And that is what's happening. But this is viewed for your wealthier clients as a tax benefit, because the donor spouse, as he or she is paying this income tax, is reducing his or her future taxable estate. So that becomes something that the donor spouse wants to be able to do. Someone has to pay income tax on income. If we make the donee spouse, the beneficiary spouse, the taxpayer, that's going to reduce the funds in the trust. This way, the funds in the trust are not being reduced at all. The funds in the trust can grow and not be taxable. Well, if they're growing, who's getting the income? The beneficiary spouse or the children or grandchildren? Who's paying the income tax? The donor spouse. You might stop there and say, well, wait a minute. If the donor spouse is paying all the tax and the donee spouse or the children are getting all the money, isn't the donor spouse making a gift to the other people in the family or to the trust for their benefit? And the law here is very clear. The answer is absolutely not. There is no gift being made here. Revenue Ruling 2004-64, very clearly says that the donor spouse, because it's a grantor trust, is paying his or her own income tax liability. There is no gift being made. The donor spouse, as the grantor trust rules require, is required to pay that income tax. Because the donor spouse is paying the income tax, does that make the donor spouse have to include the property in his or her estate? And the answer is no. Why not? Because the donor spouse has not retained any control over the trust. It's not revocable. The donor spouse isn't entitled to any income, therefore not includable in the grantor donor spouse's estate. So this is working now. Obviously, you have to make sure that the donor spouse is going to have enough liquidity to be able to pay the income tax. And so that becomes an important point. You have to understand and explain to the donor spouse that he or she will be the income tax payer for the income in the trust. Now, maybe the trust doesn't generate a lot of income. Maybe it's invested in assets that are sold from time to time and hopefully generate capital gain, taxing at a lower rate. We'll have to see how that's going to work. But this is important to understand for the donor spouse. But it is also possible to put language in the trust allowing an independent trustee. This again is permitted by Revenue Ruling 2004-64, allowing an independent trustee in the discretion of that trustee to reimburse the grantor for some of the income tax expense that the grantor incurs. The trustee has to be independent, can't be the spouse of the grantor, the children of the grantor, an employee of the grantor. It has to be an independent trustee. But interestingly, there is case law that identifies independent trustees, certainly banks and trust companies, but also attorneys and accountants, as long as you're not a family member of the grantor. So even if the attorney or the accountant does the bidding of the grantor, does whatever the grantor asks, you're still independent in the eyes of the law. So these are things that we want to create as part of the structure that we're working out. Now, if the grantor trust aspect of this is troublesome, and it is for some clients, because they say, I like everything you're saying about using my exclusion, and everything you're telling me makes sense, and I get it, but they say, the part about me paying all the income tax is troublesome because maybe I'm going to run out of money at some point, run out of sufficient liquidity to comfortably write the check every year that absorbs the income tax liability. And I say, okay, I have another way to make this work. What we can do is we can say that if there are going to be distributions being made, you need the consent of an adverse party. All right, so that means that before you can make a distribution to a beneficiary, you have to get someone who is also a beneficiary to say it's okay. So you say to the children, you can tell mom or dad that you don't get any money because you have the right to say that. If that's the case, then it's not going to be a grantor trust, because when the consent of an adverse party is involved to allow distributions to be made, you don't have a grantor power. You don't have a grantor trust. So what does that mean? That means the trust becomes the taxpayer. So maybe in some cases, if you are trying to avoid the grantor trust characterization, to avoid having the grantor be viewed as the only source of tax payment, you could insert the required permission, consent of an adverse party to eliminate the grantor status of the trust. But then you're making the trust a taxpayer, and now the trust has those compressed tax rates that at just over $13,000, you're in the 37% bracket. A married couple doesn't hit that bracket until over $600,000. So these are trade-offs that you need to be talking to the clients about. It may be that if you keep it a grantor trust and the beneficiary spouse shares with the donor spouse some of the income, that shared income will be enough to help the grantor spouse pay the income tax. So these are discussions that you need to have with the clients before you just have them sign this document and then figure out what they want to do. But these are the things that they need to be thinking about. Once again, it's very important to keep in mind that even though the SLAT will be viewed as a grantor trust, for income tax purposes, it is not a taxable estate trust for estate tax purposes, because we have set it up in a way where the grantor donor has no retained interest in the trust. The beneficiary did not transfer assets to the trust. He or she is merely a beneficiary. And that's why we once again emphasize, don't contribute joint property to the SLAT. Don't contribute community property to the SLAT. Make sure you're using separate property. Don't split the gift, because the donee spouse is a donee. You can't split gifts with yourself. So keep the gift splitting discussion aside in these circumstances. The good news is the SLAT property will not be included in the estate of either spouse, donor, or beneficiary. The bad news under current law is there won't be any basis adjustment to fair market value at either death. So let's say donor spouse funds the trust, donor spouse dies first, the basis doesn't change in the trust. Whatever the donor spouse's own basis in the assets of the trust happen to be, that's the basis to the trust, not the fair market value on the date the donor spouse creates the trust. The donor spouse has a carryover basis of his or her own tax basis to the trust assets. When the donee spouse dies, because there's no inclusion in the donee spouse's estate, there's no basis adjustment. So once again, the carryover basis continues from donor to donee. And if the children are the beneficiaries and they're not including it in their estates because they only have a life estate, the basis just keeps moving on. Now, are we upset about that? Well, we are kind of upset about it under current law, because we always want to have basis adjustments. However, take a look at what Senator Van Hollen is suggesting, what President Biden is suggesting, what Senator Sanders is suggesting. They're all talking about eliminating fair market value at death as the basis to an heir. They're talking about having an income tax liability suddenly arise at death. They're making death a realization event. That's the proposal that's being floated around. So that would mean that when a person dies, anything that they own, there would be a tax based on the spread between what they paid for it and its fair market value. So the SLAT will help remove assets from the donor's estate before that becomes law, should it become law. And if we're going to not have stepped up basis, and I call it stepped up, no guarantee assets always go up, they can go down. You know, think of the client that bought Apple stock at $50 a share and now it's worth hundreds. They would love stepped up basis at death, but that same person might have purchased General Electric stock at 40 and it's 13 today. They're not looking for fair market value at death basis. That's going to be a step down. They'd be best off selling that GE stock before they died and having a tax loss opportunity. So not everything goes up. We know that. But if they're going to change the rule and eliminate fair market value basis at death, the fact that we're having this continuing multi-generational trust without basis adjustments will not be harmful. It's like, well, so what? We're not going to have this issue, so we don't care. Again, another thing to be thinking about. In designing the SLAT, who should you name as a trustee? It should not be the donor spouse, because that's going to put that person in control. And when you're in control, there's a lot of code sections that would suggest that maybe that property should be includable in your estate. You don't want any risk of that happening. Should the donee spouse, the beneficiary spouse, be the trustee? Well, that's a possibility, but if we make the beneficiary spouse the trustee, if the beneficiary spouse has no limitation on his or her discretion, you get into the technical rule of maybe you gave the beneficiary spouse a general power of appointment. And if you gave the beneficiary spouse a general power of appointment, the property is now included in the beneficiary spouse's estate, exactly the result you don't want. So you have to be careful here. if you don't restrict the discretion of the beneficiary spouse, if you make that person the trustee, you're going to have a tax problem. You're going to have the, at least the potential argument by the IRS that if you say to the beneficiary spouse, you can take anything you want from this trust. You can take the income, the principal, we don't care. You're the trustee, do whatever you want. If it reads that broadly, and we might not use those exact words, but that's how it could be viewed, if there's no limit on your discretion, that sounds like a general power of appointment. That would be an estate inclusion for the beneficiary. That's bad. So at the very least, if you're going to make the beneficiary spouse a trustee, distributions should be subject to an ascertainable standard. The ascertainable standard means you can only make distributions to satisfy your need for health, education, maintenance, or support. So that becomes a potential ascertainable standard. Personally, I don't recommend ever making the donor spouse the trustee or making the beneficiary spouse the trustee, because there are too many issues that could be a concern there. If you're going to make the beneficiary spouse the trustee, then you need another trustee. You should have an independent co-trustee that serves with the non-donor spouse, with the beneficiary spouse, and don't allow the beneficiary spouse to exercise discretion. So what would that mean? You could say that the spouse of the donor is a trustee, but he or she may not exercise any discretion with respect to distributions. He or she can be a trustee to know what the assets are being invested in, be in a position to argue with the independent trustee about certain administrative issues of the trust. That's all okay. But when it comes to discretion about distributions, all of that discretion belongs to the independent trustee. That way, you're going to avoid the concern of having an inclusion of the assets in the estate of the beneficiary spouse. And that's something we definitely, definitely want to avoid. So these are some of the things that are important as you're looking ahead. And the problem you're going to run into, the very practical problem, is your client is going to say, first of all, he or she wants to be the trustee, saying, well, I'm putting all this money into a trust. Why can't I be the manager? Well, because if you're the trustee with discretion, you're perhaps giving yourself an estate tax problem that we want to avoid. Then the person will say, all right, I'll name my spouse as a trustee. Then you're back to saying, well, you can do that. But if the spouse has too much control and too much discretion, you're going to have a potential inclusion in the spouse's estate, which you don't want to have that happen either. So then they kind of throw up their hands and say, well, what do you want to tell me to do? And then this is when you say, ideally, you have independent trustees. If you insist on having family members, then they can be trustees, but don't give them discretion to make distributions. And this is the discussion that we often have. And some clients will be frustrated by that advice, and some will go home and think about it and never call you again. That happens sometimes, but I would rather not be called again and not lose sleep over the fact that I allowed a client to have a trust that I know is a ticking time bomb at some point. I'd rather say, look, if this isn't working for you, there are other planning opportunities you can take advantage of. This may not be for you. And maybe they'll think about it and they'll come back and they'll say, all right, I don't like some of this, but I understand it's to protect me from higher taxes, so I'm willing to go along with it. Well, then who's your independent trustee? It doesn't have to be someone you don't know. It can be your attorney, your accountant. It can be your broker, your insurance executive, someone that's not a family member who is going to be a fiduciary and will have to satisfy basic fiduciary standards, but it doesn't mean they have to be hostile. So these are things, discussions that you can have as we go forward. How do we address the SLAT and creditors? If you do it well and you do it correctly, the SLAT can also not only be a tax planning opportunity, but also an asset protection opportunity. So if we put money into a SLAT, what are we thinking about? What we're thinking about is there a problem today? Is there a situation where the grantor, the donor spouse, is being sued for something, has creditors chasing him or her, is in the middle of a lawsuit, or is a threatened lawsuit. If you set up a trust with those circumstances surrounding you, the law calls that a fraudulent conveyance, which means that if your creditors want to get at this money, just because you tried to bury it in a trust, you didn't bury it soon enough. You were in the midst of being sued, or you had some liability issue that you're trying to avoid. That's called a fraudulent conveyance, and therefore you're not going to get it away from creditors. However, if it's not a fraudulent conveyance, no one's suing you, you're fine. If someone sues you in the future, well, when is that going to happen? Years and years later, you're fine. So if you set it up as a proper gift, no fraudulent conveyance, no lawsuits involved, now the assets are no longer subject to the claims of the donor's creditors. And if the trust is properly drafted with the spendthrift clause and other provisions, the creditors of the donee spouse, the beneficiary spouse, will have no claim against the trust either. In some states, this is more favorably viewed than others. There are things called domestic asset protection trusts. You can make the SLAT a DAPT, a domestic asset protection trust. And if you create that trust in one of the, I believe it's 19 states now that have domestic asset protection trust laws, you're going to get significant protection from creditors so long as there's no fraudulent conveyance being involved. Nevada is one of the leading states for DAPTs. Other states, recently Indiana and Connecticut, adopted DAPT statutes. There are a number of states that basically say that if no one is suing you and you set up a trust in our state and you put your intangible assets here, your stocks and bonds and bank accounts, things of that type, if no one sues you, general rule, within 2 years of having set up this trust, nobody can come after you. These assets are protected against creditor claims. Other states aren't nearly as generous. Other states will say that if there is an ascertainable standard in the trust that says money should be used for your support, then they somehow imply or find an obligation on the part of the trustee to have to make distributions for the support of the person. And if you're going in that direction, that's not the direction you want to go. Why not? Because then a creditor can go to court and say, nothing is being used from this trust for the support of this beneficiary. Beneficiary is entitled to this support. Money should be paid. And P.S., we're the creditor. We can step in front of it and take it. And there are those states that are favor creditors, whereas other states are favoring debtors these days. So we have to be, it's another level of thought in these circumstances. Ideally, you have clients that have no issues with creditors at all, that they're in professions where they're properly insured. They're not worried about having surprise creditors in the future. They don't have huge debt. All that works. If they are engaged in dangerous professions, they're surgeons, they're OBGYN doctors, they're engineers or architects designing buildings in Florida that may collapse, whatever they're doing, maybe they're a good candidate to look at the domestic asset protection trust states and then set up the SLAT in those states. So now you've got the benefit of multiple planning opportunities. You've saved some gift tax, maybe a lot of gift tax. You've saved some transfer tax at death. And you've also created a mechanism where asset protection becomes important. So these are some of the benefits that we see in this SLAT opportunity. And this is partly why it has become such a go-to plan around the country. We can talk about more sophisticated planning opportunities. We can talk about grantor trust, grantor retained annuity trust, GRATs, and we can talk about intentionally defective grantor trust, IDGETs. Wonderful planning techniques, but these are planning techniques that require people of more significant wealth, perhaps, and a higher level of sophistication, or at least the willingness to accept a higher level of sophisticated planning. Many clients are okay with that, but many are not. Many say, I don't even understand what you're talking about. So then you step back and you say, all right, what about this SLAT opportunity? Create a trust for your spouse, fund it with the gift exclusion, and have your spouse enjoy the money and share it with you. That's all you really have to say to get them to understand how it's going to work. That said, now it's your job to prepare the appropriate document that makes it work. And then when it's drafted, explain it to them. But you can do that. You don't change the basic explanation of what I just said. Use your exclusion, benefit your spouse, keep money out of your estate, keep money out of your spouse's estate. Hopefully, your spouse shares with you the benefits of the trust that you are creating. Okay? That's it. Client can understand that. That's a lot easier to understand than some of the more sophisticated planning techniques that we all can draft as attorneys. We all can explain to the client. But sometimes, if your clients are like mine, after a 10 or 15 minute explanation of some of these sophisticated techniques, you see that blank look reaches their face and they're saying, I don't want to sign a document that I'll never understand. And my family won't understand it. And I don't want to deal with that. Okay, the SLAT is not that complicated document. And that's why, as I say, we're seeing the SLAT with the popularity that it has generated last year and this year. We're seeing people realizing that the SLAT is the way to achieve the use it or lose it opportunity without making an outright gift. Because the other choice is, if you don't want a trust like this, fine. Give your children $11 million. And it won't be in your estate. It won't be in your spouse's estate. But how comfortable are you giving them $11 million? Even if it's in a trust, you're stepping away completely from your control. You're stepping away completely from the opportunity for you to enjoy or share some of the benefits of that $11 million gift, or a seven or six or five, you pick the number, million dollar gift. That's simple. Give it away. Give your property away. Use your exclusion, and you're done. You don't need me to draft a document. Just write a check. But then when the clients hear that, then they say, well, my children are maybe a little immature. They're spendthrifts. They're in a bad marriage. Maybe they have issues of, sadly, disability, or maybe they have issues of addiction, whether it's drugs or alcohol or gambling or something. And if they share that with you, then you say, well, you really need a trust. You're a bad candidate for an outright gift. Let's go back and rethink the SLAT. Let's talk about how that will achieve your goals and still benefit your children, but benefit your spouse and you in the first instance. Okay. Then maybe that gets them to think about it. I mean, you have to, every client has to be, I hate to use the word managed, in a sense that we make it seem like they're not wise. So the clients are fine, but they have to be managed to show them you have a list of options. Which options are comfortable for you? I can achieve tax saving in a number of ways: outright gift, trust gift, charitable gift. Give all your money to charity. Sometimes when I sit down with a new client and they say, I hate the idea of paying taxes. And I say, what are you worth? They give me a number. So good, leave it all to charity. We're done. And then they look at me and say, well, maybe I don't hate taxes that much. I want to help my family. Then we start talking about the more appropriate planning techniques. But this is the management you have to go through. Clients come in angry about paying taxes, and we can fix that, but we have to get them comfortable with what we want them to do. There are certainly marital risks in the SLAT, and the clients need to understand that. One of the first marital risks would be, what if the beneficiary spouse dies? So A and B are married. A sets up the SLAT for B, and then B dies. What do you do now? Who are the beneficiaries? Well, the property isn't coming back to A. And if B was sharing with A, as the hope would be, B is now gone. And so now the trust says upon B's death, the children become the beneficiaries. Will the children share with spouse A? Maybe not. Maybe they have their own needs. Maybe they're married themselves and their spouse says, why should we help your parent? We need help ourselves. We need a new home. We have to educate our kids. We have to buy things that we need. So why are we helping out your parent? Well, you hear that sometimes. So you need to be protective if the beneficiary spouse dies? How can I suggest to a client that protection? One way would be to acquire a life insurance policy on the life of the beneficiary spouse. The donor spouse buys a policy on the life of the beneficiary spouse and immediately has the policy held in an irrevocable life insurance trust. That way, the beneficiary will be the donor spouse, but the property will not be included in the donee spouse's, the beneficiary spouse's estate. He or she's the insured, but if the policy's in a trust from day one, there's not even a three-year look-back issue, it will not be part of the beneficiary spouse's estate. Okay, so now we've created something that's going to work. It's going to work where if the beneficiary spouse dies before the donor spouse is now the beneficiary of a life insurance policy in a trust that says pay all the income of the donor spouse. That way the income will be available to the donor spouse, but the policy proceeds, unless they become income over time, are not going to be part of anybody's estate. So that's a good plan. That's a way to hedge against the beneficiary spouse dying a lot sooner than one might expect. What about divorce? Divorce is a bigger problem because maybe the donee spouse says, well, thank you for the gift of $11 million. I don't need you anymore, so I'm leaving. Well, terrible. That would be terrible, of course, but it could happen. So now there won't be any sharing. If the beneficiary spouse is elsewhere and not sharing with the donor spouse, the donor spouse's plan of enjoying the sharing in the slat, that's over. All right, so now what do we do? Some people would say, well, I'm not going to set this up because my spouse may walk out on me and now this is terrible and I'll have nothing. Well, not so fast. We can fix this. One way to fix it is when you draft the slat, you put language in the slat that says, in the event of a divorce of the donor and the beneficiary spouse, a trust protector or a trustee that you name is authorized to add a beneficiary to the trust, but that beneficiary that is added must be a lineal descendant of the grandparents of the donor.
At this time, I will take a moment to give the program code to attorneys who want Illinois, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Utah CLE credit for this program. Attorneys from these six states should get their participant critique or evaluation forms now to record the full program code. The code is 586, S as in Sam, G as in George, S as in Sam, 727110. Again, the code is 586, S as in Sam, G as in George, S as in Sam, 727110.
All right. Who are the lineal descendants of the grandparents of the donor? The donor. So spouse B says, I've had it, I'm leaving. Spouse A calls up the independent trustee or trust protector and says, help, my spouse is leaving. My spouse will get all the distributions. I'll get nothing unless you add me to the trust. And if the trustee and trust protector is someone that is sympathetic and understanding the family and doesn't want to see that happen, and then you pick someone who would protect you, the trust protector says, I hereby appoint the donor as an additional beneficiary. So now you're back in the game. Now, maybe by being put back in the game because you're the transferor, you may have some estate tax risk in the future. But if you had no access to any money and you needed the access, that might be a result you're willing to accept. You hope it doesn't happen. This is the fail-safe planning. This is the what-if planning. That's what we're dealing with. If you don't want to worry about the divorce with this additional beneficiary being chosen, another way to approach this is you have each spouse create a slat for the other. So if your family is wealthy enough, or if there are enough assets and you just divide them in half, A creates a slat for B, B creates a slat for A. That way, if one spouse wants to divorce the other, they each have their own slat where they're each a beneficiary. If one spouse dies, the surviving spouse still has a slat for which he or she is the beneficiary. Okay, so that's another way to make this work, and then you don't have to worry about the acrimony of divorce or even bringing up divorce in the discussion with the clients. All right, so is this the simple solution? Well, this is tax law. There's never a simple solution. What do we need to do now? We have to be careful of something the law calls the reciprocal trust doctrine, because if A creates a trust for B and B creates a trust for A, the IRS has plenty of ammunition to step up and say, neither of you has really given away anything. Let's say A and B together have $20 million. A gives 10 to B, B gives 10 to A. What have they really done? Well, really nothing. They really haven't changed anything if they've just swapped trusts that are identical. That's the key word, identical. If they are identical, you're in a problem with the IRS. The IRS can put those two trust documents together and they can say neither spouse really walked away from any assets or changed anything. So, what do we do to avoid the reciprocal trust doctrine? That becomes something important. The IRS has a US Supreme Court case called United States versus State of Grace that does recognize the reciprocal trust doctrine as a real problem, as a real issue. It is something that they bring up from time to time to say, these trusts, we don't have to recognize these trusts. We can say that each person really is in exactly the same position that they were in before they did anything. They each have half the family assets in trust with themselves, and the trust documents, the trust provisions are identical. You've done nothing, and we're not going to respect this. Neither of you made a real gift. Neither of you has created an exclusion from your estate. So that would be terrible. Based on all this work you're doing, you don't want to be doing this. And if you're the professional who creates exactly reciprocal trust and this blows up on your client, they're going to come back to you and say, you should have known about these rules. And we're not going to accept this. We're going to sue you for the taxes that we're going to have to pay. So, how do we avoid the reciprocal trust doctrine? Not difficult. We just have to be aware of it. So, we have to make sure that there are differences and distinctions if we're setting up multiple slats for this family. And so, how do we start? One thing that I often recommend is you set up the trust in different states. And people say, oh my goodness, that's really complicated. No, it's not. You pick a state that's a friendly state that doesn't have an income tax, Nevada, South Dakota, Delaware for non-residents, Alaska, Wyoming, Texas, Florida. All those states do not have income taxes. So that's a good start. In many of these states, I know in Nevada, because I work with them, some of the trustees charge exceptionally low rates, very fair trustee rates to be your trustee. They may not want to do a lot of work, but they don't have to. You give them instruction, they're your trustee. So I could have a trust in state A and a trust in state B with trustees there. I can live in state C. As long as the trust is appropriate in the state, doesn't matter where I am. So I have trusts in different states. Then I'll pick different trustees. I'll have a trustee in state A, a trustee in state B. So now I've got two distinctions, different states, different trustees. Then I'll put in some dispositive provisions that are not identical. So maybe in one, I'll say that the spouse has the obligation to receive all the income every year or half the income every year. In the other trust, I'll say the trustee has complete discretion to pay income to the spouse or not pay income to the spouse. Maybe in one, I'll say children or more remote descendants are acceptable beneficiaries when they're 25 years old. And others I'll say when they're 40 years old. I mean, I will put provisions in that are different enough and truly substantive enough. I'm not talking about putting a comma in one trust and not the other. That's silly. I'm talking about substantive provisions that are different. Maybe in one trust, we give a beneficiary spouse a limited power of appointment to appoint the trust property at death to children. And we give a general power in the other, or a different limited power in the other, maybe to appoint property to grandchildren. I can find enough distinctions, enough differences, enough points that are different enough that if the IRS gets a ton of slats that they're looking at. And there are hundreds and hundreds of slats being drafted all over the country as we are speaking, because people are now becoming very aware that in the next couple of months, it is very possible that the Senate, through what they call reconciliation, can pass a 51 to 50 statute in October of this year and change the tax law. So we're getting closer to the potential change or the date when this happens. It might be effective in October, maybe January 1 of the next year. It may not pass at all. All remains to be seen. But as I was saying to you earlier, do you want to be the person that wakes up in the morning and finds out it all happened and it's too late? No, we want to be the people out in front of that. So we're thinking about different ways to make the trust work. The reciprocal trust doctrine is avoidable. And that's really important. So as you're thinking about this, what I picture is if there are hundreds of trusts out there and the IRS examiner, auditors are brought in as slat experts, and they put one family's trust down on the table and they start looking at page by page and they see major distinctions. And then they see, okay, I'll put that one aside. Then they see another family's trust, but everything's the same. The only thing different is the name is the beneficiary. Spouse A is the grantor of one, the beneficiary of two, and vice versa with spouse B. Everything else is identical. That's the one they're going to focus on, not the one that I'm drafting or you're drafting that's going to have all these distinctions. And they're going to say, is it worth fighting in court to say, well, these distinctions aren't big enough to get around the reciprocal trust doctrine when lots of people are being less careful and creating these situations where we have these issues. So this is something that can work. In summary, the slat is a wonderful planning technique for the situation that we're in. We have this amazing exclusion, $11.7 million, never been bigger. It may go away. Political risk is suggesting it may go away, and not just diminished a little bit where we're not going to feel a change. The 99.5% Act would take 11.7 million, drag it down to 1 million for lifetime gifting, 3.5 million for transfers at death. That is a significant, significant difference from where we are now. So we have this opportunity to use this exclusion. The simple way to use it, just make an outright gift. But if you do that, are you comfortable with your donees, your kids, your grandkids, your spouse? They have total control over the wealth. That's not a trust. A trust has the advantage of allowing as much distribution to be made to the beneficiaries as reasonable and possible, but at the same time, controlling the pace of that, controlling when it can happen. If you have appropriate inheritors who want to build a home, start a business, they're starting a family, they want to educate their children, and you're totally in favor, make the distributions, but from a trust. If those same people have issues down the road, creditor issues, judgment, financial creditors, matrimonial creditors, their own personal demons occur, the trust can protect them. So simple gifting, fine. Otherwise, use a trust. And the slant is the wonderful solution under current law to take advantage of the ability to use your exclusion now before it goes away, to get some asset protection benefits, to get some maybe some generation skipping benefits, all in one planning document. So with that, I hope this has been a good explanation of the slant. Most important slide is always the last one that says thank you for your attention to the program on behalf of National Law Foundation and NLF Forms, where you can find the SLAT form along with many others. This has been Steve Siegel. Thank you very much for your attention today.